Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode?
In today's episode, we're going to be talking about gendering economics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
So, Brooke, one of the core social studies classes is economics.
What?
And I know.
It's one of my favorites.
Every high schooler has to take economics before they graduate. It's typically the responsibility of the social studies teacher to teach that course. It hit me hard just how important it is to gender economics curriculum. And it's weird because, like, we're a history podcast, but really our goal is to reform social studies ed. And when certainly talking about women who existed in history is important, but the reason it's important is because social studies is about thinking about the society we're in right now. Mm-hmm. And so by showing people that women existed in the past, we're giving them role models for their lives, right?
Yeah. Women in business, women in, you know, industry, women who are creating jobs and right. economies and
right.
breaking right. the mold.
We did our TED Talk years ago now. And
yes, we did. It's on YouTube.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who is a Harvard professor who coined the phrase, well-behaved women seldom make history. Do you know her?
Oh, yeah.
Casual.
It's like a phrase no one hears. What?
Right. She sent us an email. Having watched our TED Talk.
Way to bury the lead.
Right. And she said that she really liked it. But was concerned that we aren't grounding our history in a deep enough, our commentary on a deep enough understanding of economics. And so that feedback sort of like sent me down a like, whoa, what are we not doing enough of, right? And the more research I've done into the writing of women's history, it's about rethinking how we value the labor that women tend to do. So I think this is a really great way to not only think about it from a historical perspective, but then I think most importantly, where economics is directly taught is in personal finance, micro and macroeconomic courses mm-hmm. in high schools. And so the more I'm sitting with that, the more I'm realizing personal finance, micro and macro each need to be gendered. And we need to reframe some of these concepts. And when we teach about things like supply and demand or GDP, mm-hmm. we need to be having conversations with our students that lack of, you know, I'm repeating myself here, but we need to be gendering those things. Let's gender GDP. Let's gender supply demand.
Well, and it's important. So it brings women into the conversation for the students. So it wasn't just male dominated industry.
Yep.
And so that women can really, and men can sit in that classroom and say, oh, by not including women or by not bringing them into these conversations, we're actually missing a huge component of propulsion
right.
and moving forward and really yep. impacting financial well-being.
Yeah. So before we get too deep into this, I want to just share a little business update with everybody about our project. We are in the process, speaking of economics, of dropping our online textbook for economics and government. I know. So if you're like, yeah, sounds like a great idea, Kelsey, but like, how am I literally going to do that in my classes? Don't worry. We have economics and political science professors helping us write a ninth grade textbook for those things. So we're going to have four chapters for each of those courses available to you to get those things into your curriculum. And then, as always, we will have inquiry-based lesson plans to help you do the thing.
When does that drop?
End of January.
End of January. Put it on your calendars, folks.
Yep.
Economic textbook available to you.
End of January.
It's exciting.
So very, very exciting. And part of our grant from the Library of Congress was building those inquiry-based lesson plans. So there's 40 new lesson plans. About half of those are world history, and then the rest of them are government and economics to help you literally teach the curriculum grounded in the standards, grounded in the frameworks. to your students. And all of that is possible because of that grant that we got and because of the patrons who are making it possible to keep our website up.
Thank you.
So these free resources, these things that are literally going to guide you into doing what we're going to talk about on the podcast today, are only possible because people are contributing funds to make these resources available. So if you want to join our, I think we are up to like 30 donors now who are monthly contributors to our podcast.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So if you want to join those people, you can do so at remedialherstory.com/giving.
We also had several this year, people that donated for a full 12 months that wanted just to do a one-time payment. And that was really kind and very generous.
Yeah.
And that really helps us impact our planning so we can, you know, think about the year ahead and what we want to impact and getting more resources like this textbook to you.
Yeah. So if you want to make a sort of an annual one-time donation, you can do that at remedialherstory.com/giving. The details about our nonprofit, our 501c3 status, all those things are available to you on that page.
Yep.
And if you're old school and you want to send a check, we are P.O. Box 412 in Plymouth, New Hampshire.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good.
So thank you, thank you, thank you to our donors and thank you to those of you who are considering doing it too. So let's talk about economics. I think in general, we need to break, you know, your phrase is you need to break your brain, right? So we need to break our brain about work. To bring some history into it. The Industrial Revolution transformed the labor force by creating this idea of there's work that's paid and there's work that's unpaid. And so when we talk about women going into industries, we need to remember that there's entire industries that do work that is unpaid. And
okay, like what's an example?
Housekeeping, caregiving, child rearing, all of that is...
You don't get paid?
I'm just kidding. Well, what's interesting about it is some people do get paid.
Yes.
Right? Like there are... Nannies. Child care providers. There are nannies, right? There are housekeepers that you pay. But then there are some people that do that labor for their families and they don't get paid.
Right.
When all of this relates, I think a lot of teachers in economics probably mention the pay gap. And I we can get into that. But if you back up away from that pay gap, one of the things that's true is that women tend to work fewer hours a week than men on average.
Right.
So it's something like 7 and 8. But what is misleading about that information is that those same women go home and they pick up their second shift, which is what it's referred to by people who study this. Their second shift, which is doing the domestic labor their home.
They work their 7 to 5 and then they go home and do their 5 to 7.
Right. And there, they're actually putting in more hours than men on average. And so when you add up the work that women are doing, not the paid work, but the work that women are doing, they're working more hours than men. And they're not making, like, they're not getting paid for those additional hours. They're volunteering that time for their family, for their loved ones, right? For their elderly parents that they care for.
Yeah, and please hear us. We're not saying it's not rewarding.
Right.
There's rewards to paid work and unpaid work. However, we're talking about, you know, financial ramifications of these things.
Right. So when we're thinking about personal finance, we have to remember that we still have a system that is tied to paid work. Mm-hmm. So what's tricky about this when
we're talking about the U.S. economic system.
The U.S. economic system. So our system, I think it's something like 12% of men get paternity leave. Mm-hmm. Those that do take an average of like 2 weeks.
Of right? Like the 6 that they get offered.
Right.
Or 12.
Right. Women are the ones that are often getting those maternity leaves. It's sort of this like crucial moment where, you know, all things in general had been equal up to that moment of having children. And that's sort of the turning point. And when you think about this from a personal finance perspective, what we need to prepare all of our students for is that really big difference in the leave that people get, the way that that impacts their pay moving forward. For women, it's considered the motherhood penalty.
Yep.
For men, it's the fatherhood bonus. They end up getting 6% more in pay as a result of becoming a father. Just this like a sort of unearned reward at work just well, because
there's a lot of biases that go along with that of people feel that those who are, so the studies that show why fathers get more money is because they're viewed as more stable and that they're more loyal to a company.
Right.
So the company is more willing to invest in them financially because they'll probably stay because they have risks.
Right.
Young single professionals often don't get that financial reward because people see them as a flight risk and they're not loyal to a business. So there's double sides of this too, but it's really interesting the when finances of payroll come into mm-hmm. it and the statistics behind why people get raises, mm-hmm. you're like, wait a second.
Right. So what's interesting about that though is like that fatherhood bonus works out great if you're married and cohabitating with the father.
Right.
But what if you're not?
Yeah, that person's right. getting extra in their retirement. They're getting extra in their annual income. Their right. home is being rewarded. Your home is not.
That's a patriarchal system.
Right.
Right. In a lot of states, when the mother is pregnant, child support doesn't kick in until after the baby is born, which is a whole comment on like when life begins and blah, 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 blah. But also, like,
and that's state by state regulated too. So that's not federal government regulated.
Right.
There are federal laws about childcare and paternity, but they're not wide sweeping and they're often state to state.
Right. So those mothers have to pay their health care, right?
Oh, yeah.
Out of their pocket.
And their child's.
They have to be employed the entirety of their pregnancy, which is like not a big deal, you know, like for some people. But if you're having one hell of a pregnancy, which definitely happens to women, right? Like they are screwed when it comes to health care because of the way that our system operates if they're not connected to employment. Right? Either through their partner or through themselves.
Right.
So,
and a lot more employers are covering benefits for spouses, even though if they're not married, those things are happening and those are starting to change. And so trends in the US are changing, but not fast enough to really make a significant impact on the economy of women.
Right. So all of those things are related to personal finance. And I think it is removed from our high schoolers' lives because it's like, oh, that's 20 years from now, right? Or whatever, maybe 10 years from now. But like that is their financial future. And the whole point of personal finance is to prepare them for those moments of difference.
Yeah. Well, and we're not even getting into too as education. You know, this is part of the economy as well. So students going through your classroom, thinking about after high school, what they want to do, whether they want to go on a career or go to college and what that looks like. The number of monies available to female high school students versus male high school students, they're still inequitable.
Right.
So they're also starting out from behind a starting line that men are already ahead of still.
Right.
And so that's something too that women have to go for more financial aid. They have to go for more grants and more scholarships if they want to go.
Yeah.
I mean, more women are going to college than men. That is a change in the statistics.
And graduating.
And graduating at higher rates. So there is that swing. But that also means then they're graduating with debt.
Right.
Loans. Money that they now have to go into their career with.
Right.
And then go get, you know, funds for.
Yeah. So navigating these choices. I want to point everybody to Claudia Golden, just won the Nobel Prize for Economics this year.
Claudia.
And she's one of the few women who've ever won that. She was the first woman at Harvard to get tenure in the economics department. So she's like a history-making woman herself. But she published a book called Career and Family. And I cannot recommend this more to high school teachers to read. What she does is she basically chronicles the lives of women across multiple generations in the 20th century into today, into the 21st. And she looks at how these women, so women born around the turn of the century, what their options were for career and family. And essentially, it was career mm-hmm. or family.
You don't get right? both.
You don't get both of those things.
Close those doors.
Boom. In the next generation, they had you know, sort of like short careers, and then they had families, and then they tried to resume their careers, right?
And so they have this like giant break.
Yeah. And I'm really oversimplifying her story, but now, you know, there's women who tried to push back their, you know, push back family as long as they could so they could have these substantive careers. And that was only made possible because of things like the pill, which didn't exist for earlier also, generations.
Also, on the other end, if you wanted to become a parent, IVF right. has advanced significantly.
So that's the next generation, is they have IVF available to them. So she's looking at sort of these like structural scientific changes that are happening, and legalization of things, right? That's part of the structure.
Yep.
And how that's transforming career and family for generations of women. And for me, reading the book, it actually made me respect my mom and my grandmother and the choices that they made.
Oh my gosh, I think about it all the time. So my grandmother couldn't take a credit card out in her name.
Yeah.
She couldn't get a loan.
Yeah.
So she was going to medical school to become a nurse. And she met my grandfather. And she was, you know, not from a well-to-do family. They were farmers in Ohio. But she wanted to go to college and become a nurse. And this was something she really wanted to do. And I can remember her saying, like, she had to go to a bank with her father. And her father had to make sure that he was on all of her accounts until she was married. Yeah. And then when she was married, those accounts transferred to my grandfather.
Right.
She couldn't independently own money.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not that long ago.
Right.
That's not that, that's my grandmother.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's, you know, 60s.
Yeah.
It's 50s, 60s.
But the ramifications of that, when it comes to personal finance, is unbelievable. Because you think about how boys are trained to manage money differently. For girls, it's like, oh, my dad handled that, right? Yeah. Like,
well, I think a great example of this in your own classrooms, I can remember taking economics in high school, and then I got to student teach with an economics professor. Had everyone raise their hand. Who controls the money in your house?
Yeah.
Who pays the bills?
Right.
If it's your father, raise your hand. If it's your mom. And it was almost 90% of the class, dads.
Yeah.
And it was like, why do you think that is?
Yeah.
Have you ever asked? Right. Ever talked to your parents?
Right.
And like, I can remember when I went to get married, my mom was like, you have your own bank account. This is your, like, have your own money. Make sure it's all yours. And my grandmother said the same thing. It was so funny, like two separate conversations with women in my family. Make sure you have your own bank account.
Yeah.
Financially independent.
Right. Yeah. And the why is not because your husbands are bad or mistrustworthy.
No,
but
no,
it's
no.
like, but you need to know the financial situation of your family, and you need to be an equal partner in that. And also, like,
and you're allowed to. I think that's some of the things too, is we talk to friends. They're like, I don't know, my husband handles that. It's like, what if he dies?
Right.
Your father passed away at a young age.
Yeah.
Your mom became the financial, you know, leader of your home.
Yep.
How equipped was she to do that?
Right.
And I think that's true for a lot. Well, it's like,
my mom was a total feminist, so she was totally fine.
But yeah. But obviously, because your mom's a baddie. But it's one of those things where it's like, no. What does your retirement look like? How are you guys doing? Like,
what's the plan?
We it's funny. We treat our marriage not like a business, but we have business meetings.
Yep.
We do financial meetings.
Finance Friday.
We do finance Sundays. Oh, we talk about like what bills are coming out this week, what's going on for the next week, how is savings looking?
You know why? The leading cause of divorce is
finance. Trying to keep our men.
Keep those marriages alive.
Trying to keep the economy of a two-income households alive.
Okay. I love my husband, and he's amazing, and we generally are very good with financial
choices.
But
if you don't agree on financial choices, if you have a spender, looking at myself, and a non-spender, my husband.
Yep.
Man, there's some battles.
So my husband and I invest in real estate, and
You guys have businesses together. That's a whole other realm. Yeah.
And he flips houses, which is great. And so we, we'll sort of be perusing the options in the local area and whatever. So one of our notorious stories about finance was he went to an auction.
Oh, he bought a house.
And he bought a house without telling me. And it's like, what? And
mine was good. Bought
he
a house.
Interpreted my anger as like, oh my God, I've inconvenienced her. And he goes, it's not a big deal. You don't have to go to the closing. Like, I'll take care of everything. I'll sign all the stuff. Da, da, da. I was like, oh no. I will be at that closing. And the line that I regularly say to him, which was completely a joke, but it was said in a joking anger, was I was like, because when I divorce you, I'm taking this house.
I'm sure the listeners that are married or have partners,
yeah,
every one of us has had that conversation. Oh, no. It's not about me, yeah, but it's for your next wife.
Yeah.
You should know. This isn't cool. Just so you know. Yeah. I always have that debate in my brain. I'm like, I could train him for this marriage.
Yeah.
But then the next one just benefits so much more.
Right.
It's so terrible. Anyway. My husband is not a child. He's a partner. But I do think that there is a lot in your economic classroom that,
yeah,
when students come in with their own perspectives of how things are handled in their homes,
yep,
there is a lot of emotion because money is emotional.
Right.
And so there's also this component of trying to show people how emotions can dictate, yep, actions and behaviors. Because part of it too is there's a lot, and I'm probably in this book that you're talking about, there's a lot of that still the patriarchal society that women should want to be home with their kids.
Yeah.
And they should want to take time off of work. And what if they're a bad mom if they don't? And I think I feel really fortunate to be part of the generation we're in,
yeah,
that seems to be really breaking.
Yeah.
And that it's very much more a partnership and husbands and wives are coming to the table a little more equally, yeah, of responsibilities of parenthood.
Well, and there's a lot of myths connected to that too, that like women somehow are
more nurturing, better, which is totally
like,
wrong.
Like their brains are wired differently to do that.
Oh, and I love the one that women can hear babies crying more.
Yeah.
That myth has been busted for years.
Right.
Men have same ears. Right. We're both humans. They can hear babies crying.
Yeah.
Knock that shit off.
Right. Well, and just as somebody who struggled with postpartum depression, I'll add one sort of like commentary there. I was having a really hard time after my first son was born for a variety of reasons. But I had multiple men tell me,
ugh,
isn't it just amazing how you automatically connect with this baby? And
the eye rolling that is happening in my face right now.
But the intention is kind and genuine, but the impact on me who didn't feel those things that there was something fundamentally flawed with me that I didn't.
Like you're a bad mom.
I wasn't connecting. It wasn't working. And, you know, and like all of that resolved because it's a chemical response to, mm-hmm, childbirth and trauma and that sort of thing. But like it all resolved itself and I have a fine connection with my son. That's not a big deal. But to have people, especially men, telling me that like somehow I was, you know, programmed differently and that not being real, you know, like.
Well, I think about it too. Like, let's go back a generation to our moms. Economics, home ec.
Yeah.
Was only offered to women in their schools.
Right.
That's probably true of some listeners.
Right.
I can remember we had home economics in my high school.
Yeah.
You could take it every year if you wanted to.
Yep.
Not really sure what people learned in there and didn't go to class. Was not where I was hanging out. I hung out in the CAD room with, mm-hmm, all the other engineers because I wanted to do architecture.
Yeah.
But they would, women, child rearing,
yep,
cooking dinner, All these things were being taught. And while they are important, they are life skill building.
Yeah.
It was predominantly women in those classes.
Right.
And it was like, wait a second.
Right.
How are you enticing more young men to come into these classrooms and building this?
Requiring more young.
Yeah. Like if you're going to say that this is life skill building. And
don't men need life skills?
Yeah. Like there's a lot of laws coming out right now about students taking financial wellness,
yeah,
as a curriculum.
Yeah.
Many states are putting it in practice.
Yep. New Hampshire just did. They passed personal finance law. It's
exactly
required. Yep.
So that's going to be a big shift as well in, yep, how economics are going to turn 20 years from now.
Right.
Having those students go through a personal finance course.
Yeah. So then, you know, you shift to the next unit, which is microeconomics, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking about owning businesses, thinking about, and it's wild and it's staggering how many women actually do own businesses, right?
Right now?
Yeah.
I feel like it's the Instagram era.
Right.
How many women do you know that are like, oh, no, I have like 4 side hustles.
Right. Yeah.
I'm like,
they do.
What?
Right.
I need passive income.
And so women are finding these business types that are flexible and available. And like, that's really cool. And to show people, you know, when you're thinking about career choices, oftentimes career counseling is guiding towards these like full-time, high commitment jobs.
That need degrees. So
right.
It's.
Right. And not that you shouldn't be showing students that path, but also some of those paths aren't realistic for students once they get into the years of child rearing. So yep. What's plan B, right? So I think that's sort of important piece.
Well, we talk about this too, of why a lot of women go into education is because it's very
flexible
for families.
Right.
You're off in the summers. You get out of school the same time your kids do.
Yep.
There's a lot of, if you want to plan for a family, there's a lot of reasons why women go into that if that's a priority for them.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting too that women continue to pick careers that still go towards their core values of how they want to show up in their life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about what they enjoy doing.
Right. Well, and I think that speaks to something that we need to break our brains around. And it goes back to that pay gap conversation about the work that women are doing is valued less.
Yep.
And that fundamentally has to change. The fact that teachers who are literally preparing the next generation of doctors, the next generation of lawyers, the next generation of you name it, right?
Yep.
They are paid less than somebody who like sits at a desk in a cubicle doing computer software design. I'm sorry, but like those jobs are equal risk, equal degrees, equal commitment, equal all of it. And the weekly pay difference is $1,000.
Yeah, think about that exponentially over time and retiring.
Right.
Like we're getting into this now where we have a really aging population in the U.S. We have a ton of people. We have boomers retiring and nowhere to go and all these different things. That's going to really shift our economy and what is going to be available when our generation retires. And so that's also something to think about. Like, no one's planning for our retirement. We can't plan on the government supporting us.
Right.
That may not be there. It's pretty likely based off what they're saying that it's not.
Yeah.
So if we're not saving for ourselves,
right,
this is going to become a very dangerous U.S. society.
Right.
We're going to have a ton of people in our 50s and 60s who did not plan or could not plan because of how our society is set up for women.
Right.
And now what do we do?
I think the challenge for economics teachers is to frame conversations about supply and demand. And there's a really great political cartoon where this guy is being interviewed by, you know, someone in the media. And he's like, wow, you've just won a bunch of awards. Tell me, how did you do it? Right. And the guy's like, oh, you know, well, I work really hard. I went to college. I show up every day, da, 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 da. And as the cartoon is, you know, moving from, you know,
slide to slide,
it's zooming out. And you see that the entire interview is happening and the guy's chair is being held up by his wife who's simultaneously vacuuming. And the point of this is, yeah, he achieved all of those amazing things. But he can only...
Because he didn't have to think about dinner and his clothes.
He only could do that because someone was supplying the other stuff.
Yeah.
Right? This is a supply and demand conversation. If he had had to pick up his child at 3 p.m., he wouldn't have been the employee who stayed extra hours into the evening to do the stuff, to win the award.
Yep.
If he had had to make dinner and prepare lunches and go to soccer games and all those other things, he wouldn't have been able to do that stuff. So back it up. What in the economy is running because of unpaid labor? And even if we don't change our pay structures, we need to create a conversation in our curriculum about supply and demand that factors in unpaid work.
And also how we're solving for it. There are some really cool studies that are happening. So Colorado is a really interesting case that you probably have talked about in your classrooms, but they pay for, so parents who have child with developmental delays or needs, they pay them an annual salary to care for that child.
Yeah.
That changes their economy significantly in Colorado of what the burdens are on their school districts and on their communities to help with children who have developmental disabilities.
Right.
That is a game changer. And the government figured it out in Colorado to do this. So it's a really interesting study of how it's impacting their communities, how it's impacting their economy, and how caretakers are moving there because of this. It's like, wait, you're going to finally pay me for the labor that I'm doing of caring for this child and this family?
Yeah.
Or others, they'll pay for others.
It's also like if you have a child that is that you know, demanding of your time and your energy, they're not a kid that you can
just get a full-time job. Right, you can't.
You can't. That's not an option.
You can't commit
for
to someone else's business being successful, right, because your business is parenting.
Right.
Oregon has the same thing for ailing and aging parents. They pay right. you to care for your aging parents.
Yeah.
What that does is it takes stuff off of their systems, their healthcare systems,
yep.
their homes, their, you know, retirement homes and communities. They're solving for a pay inequity while also really making sure that they're helping their communities and the women, essentially, that are taking care of their community.
Right. And I think all of this, you know, in Germany, they actually have different words to describe paid and unpaid work. And, you know, and what I would love to see change in economics curriculum is doing something like that, right? Where we actually are distinguishing this and calling out the bias in value, right? It's interesting because when the government is tracking employment, so in, you know, if you're teaching micro and macroeconomics, two key concepts that you should be talking about are unemployment rates, right? Inflation, right? Those sort of like, those sort of measures of how the economy is doing. And you should also be talking about GDP, right?
Yep.
So those big things. And you can teach them in the traditional way that you do, but call out the biases and how we measure that stuff. Mm-hmm. A housewife is occupied. She's employed,
yeah.
right? That's a job. And a lot of women, when the economy doesn't do well, they shift into that work because they're doing it anyway, right? Yeah. Instead of paying somebody to watch their kids, they just watch their kids, right? So someone's doing the labor, whether it's paid or unpaid,
yep.
right? So that's an important conversation about employment. When we're talking about GDP, for literally decades, maybe even centuries, women have been calling for factoring in domestic labor into mm-hmm. GDP because it's unbelievable. I mean, think about that. We are saying to women who are doing work that otherwise would be paid, hired out work, we're saying to them that they're not contributing to the product of the economy.
Yeah.
What? They're enabling, first of all, their spouses to go in and do it.
Yeah, their total household incomes, their total annual earnings. Like, no, that doesn't, no money.
Right. The other thing is, like, the women, my friends who are housewives, like, that's their occupation. They're, you know, they're providing to their home, to their family. They are teachers, right? They're yep. teaching their young children. And then every single one of them are the most crafty people I've ever met. Like, they make stuff for their house that, because I'm, you know, employed in my job at the university, I don't have time to do that stuff. And so I'm buying some cheap thing at like Marshall's while they're like home making that thing. And you're telling me that they're not providing to the GDP? They made something. That's
yeah.
a product that got, you know, traded as a gift or bartered with a neighbor or whatever. And I'm, you know, buying the cheap knockoff version of the cool thing I wish I got from my friend, you know, who's doing this incredible work caretaking and giving and providing into her local community.
Yeah.
So that giving isn't factored in. And I think a lot of people listening might be like, oh, but how would one even measure that? Well, in Claudia Golden's book, she actually talks about these pioneering female economists in the mid 20th century who created systems of measuring that stuff.
Oh.
And so when the United States was rethinking how we measure GDP, these women economists were saying, here's how you factor it in. Here's how you do it. Those examples exist, and they just weren't used by the, like, you know, government officials who are predominantly men who made the decision of how we measure GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Shocking, shocking, shocking.
Yeah.
So I can't recommend this book enough because it really is breaking my brain on, like, oh, GDP is missing entire facets of the economy.
Yeah. And I think one, you know, you can bring in so many different exercises into your classroom for this topic of really bringing in, like, okay, so let's say we take the Colorado model. Let's say we take the Oregon model. How does that impact, you know, what if you are in a four household income because you were married, you're now divorced, you have two sets of parents, they're all contributing. What does that look like? How are you yeah. measuring? You know, we talk about these family units that are atypical now, mm-hmm. are more than typical.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how do we factor these things in to the changes that are evolving, and how can we prepare our students to ask the questions like, wait, is this fair?
Right.
Should we continue doing this?
And think like an economist, right? That's the goal of economics at all, like entirely, yeah. is to get students thinking like an economist. Well, a woman economist is going to think like an economist about her situations, right? Yeah. And she does have a different financial future ahead of her than the male students because of the way the economy is
established today.
Established yeah. and structured. So I really think we need to be breaking our brains around it, gendering economics. We actually have a poster that you can find in our store online where you can, it is like a diagram to help teachers gender economics, gender government, gender history, right? Gender your psychology.
It's a great visual for students to be like, oh, never thought about it like that.
Let me think about this differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is good. There's so many great visuals that you can bring in for these topics too. And we have a bunch of lesson plans that you can come up with. And we also did a podcast, I forget how long ago, but about the triangle fire, the shirt fire. So there's a lot around, like usually people start to bring in the Industrial Revolution there. So there's a lot.
There's a lot.
Cool. Thanks, Kels.
Thanks, Brooke.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.